law school. It's an investment in your future. But like all investments, without the right advice, it can lead to disaster. That's where Pre-Law Pro comes in. Whether you're exploring the law, navigating the admissions process, or need personalized career guidance, at Pre-Law Pro, we've got your back. Don't gamble on your future. Invest in it. Get started today at prelawpro.com.
How can I make myself more competitive?
How do I build my network?
I want my career to go to the next level, but I don't really know where to start.
I hate the job I am in. What else can I do?
I want to work in healthcare, but I don't want to be a doctor.
I need connections in a new industry. Where should I start?
Whether you're a college student trying to decide on a career path, a young professional trying to develop their career, or maybe you're in the mid to late stages of your own professional journey and you're looking for a new challenge, or maybe you're facing an unexpected job search. Whoever you are, wherever you are, welcome to the Professionists Podcast. And together, let's find your fit. Adam, thanks so much for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
So before we jump into how you ended up in the world of private intelligence, tell us a little bit about your college experience, because I think even as we explore the different career paths that are out there, it's easy just to land where you are right now. Mm-hmm. But I think it's also helpful to take a step back and say, where did you come from? Where did you start?
Right, right. So I think my college experience is categorized into two separate lanes. So being my undergraduate experience and then also my graduate school experience. So as an undergrad, I went to Texas Christian University in Fort Worth and studied political science there. I had a great time, absolutely loved the school, loved the political science department. I couldn't say enough good things about it, really enjoyed it. I guess from there, I feel like a lot of political science majors, law seemed to be the next logical step. And so that's something that I thought about for a while, but being an attorney just didn't click with me. And so I thought, yeah, how am I going to spend the rest of my life? So I took some time, kind of a gap year, to think about what I wanted to do and stumbled upon the field of private intelligence. And learning more about the field, I felt like I needed to get a little bit stronger of a research background. I felt like a lot of people within the field, you know, had graduate degrees and professional degrees of different kinds. So I thought it would be great to go to graduate school. It's the field that I'm in, that we're in private intelligence, is it's a very international field. And I kind of felt like I wanted to, growing up in Canada, it's not the most exotic. I love Canada, but it's not the typical exotic, quote unquote, experience a lot of folks have. So I kind of wanted to broaden my horizons a little bit. And I felt that studying in England would be great for that. And I knew that Durham University had a program called Defense Development and Diplomacy, which it's kind of pretty self-explanatory. Realm of study is in the name, really focuses on international security and economic development. And that was, it seemed like something that I could really use as a transition into private intelligence and due diligence. And so that's kind of how I ended up in England for graduate school. And that was a fantastic experience as well. Very different, obviously, from TCU, but it was still great. I love my time at Durham. Some of my best friends now I met while I was there. Studying there was an absolutely amazing experience. So for me, to answer your question, it's really split into those two different, the undergraduate and then the graduate school experiences are kind of in two separate worlds for me.
What was the biggest difference between studying here in the United States and then heading over to Durham?
I would say the biggest difference that I noticed, and this may be just the difference between graduate school and being an undergraduate student, was in graduate school, you're very focused on your reading for your particular courses. And then in lecture, really almost having a discussion. Professors obviously guide the
seminar
discussion.
Style.
Absolutely. Yeah. The professors obviously guide the discussion, but it's something where it's a lot more focused on what we had to say, where as an undergraduate, it's very geared towards, this is what you're going to learn. Of course, your course reading. But there's a lot more of direct lectures from your professors. That's what I would say academically was the biggest difference. Mm-hmm. As far as location-wise, Durham is a very, very small town, or at least small by some of my standards compared to going to school in Fort Worth.
Yeah.
Which is a couple times larger. Both were great, and they have different experiences, but you just get a whole different dynamic kind of being, at least what seemed like, as somebody who is a Canadian and American, going from Fort Worth to what I would describe as the English countryside was very different for me. And there's so much history in Durham. It was just like a totally different experience for me on a personal level as well.
So you go to the United Kingdom, head up to the north of England, and you do this graduate degree. It's a 2-year program, and then you come back. Is it 2 years?
It was actually one year, which was fantastic. Yeah,
okay, so that's one of the big differences. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yes. And yes, for those who are interested in going to the UK for school, at least for a lot of the, not, I don't believe all programs are 1 year, but at least for mine, and I know a lot of others, I was able to complete my courses, but also my dissertation, all within the span of one calendar year, which for me was a huge plus. And I still felt like I got a lot out of it. So I think for those thinking about graduate school, obviously too, with cost being such an important factor nowadays, I think that's something that it was absolutely fantastic for me. And I think from what I've heard from other people, particularly Americans that have gone over to study in the UK, I think that was the plus for them as well.
Yeah, that's probably a good place for us to jump into the transition from finishing off your education into private intelligence. Before we talk about how you ended up at Strategic Insights Group, help us understand, what is private intelligence? Because I think when people hear the I word, they think of the alphabet agencies.
Right.
And they are obviously government intelligence, but there's this huge private intelligence industry out there. So help us understand, what is private intelligence?
Right. So I guess for me, when I say private intelligence, that kind of encompasses pre-transactional due diligence, geopolitical risk, market entry risk, all these kinds of things are within the realm of what a lot of private intelligence organizations look into. So at Strategic Insight Group, in particular, we look at a lot of our clients ask us to conduct pre-transactional due diligence work. So prior to investment, we'll go and examine the executive team of a company, the company, basically to do what we would kind of describe as a red flag check to make sure that there are no significant negative indicators that would damage our client's reputation, that would put their investment at risk, put the money of the people that they're investing with them at risk as well. But again, that's kind of in the crosshairs of political risk that all with institutional investors that are investing all over the world, political risk is always just around the corner when you're investing in a lot of different places. And so that's something that come across a lot as well. So it's a number of different areas, but that's kind of are some of the groups of work that comprise private intelligence as a whole.
You talked a little bit about doing essentially due diligence and red flag checking, which sounds a lot like the kind of due diligence that accounting firms do, where they go in and they'll check the books and make sure there's no undisclosed liabilities and so on and so forth. But I imagine this is a different kind of red flag check. You're not as interested in the financials necessarily, I'm guessing, but more in terms of like who's running the company and what are some of their exposure. So you're doing a lot of detailed background checks on individuals.
Right, yeah. So we would describe it as non-financial due diligence, exactly. So sometimes if we were doing a scan on a company and we saw an article that said company A experienced a 57% decrease in revenue in 2020, obviously, that's an area where we would flag that and say, okay, this is potentially negative. And that's something that we would look into. But you're absolutely correct. We primarily don't look at financial indicators unless they come up in the course of media and that kind of thing. It's mostly those non-financial indicators with the executive team. Are they involved in extensive amounts of litigation? Do they have any prior business failures that the client should be aware of? Are there any criminal dealings in the past that they would want to be aware of, either for reputational reasons, but also too, with a lot of professional organizations, there's certain guidelines you have to pass as far as criminal record checks and that kind of thing. So yes, we look on that kind of side and mostly focus in on the company itself, what the company's been involved in, but yes, absolutely on the executives and what makes up their background on that side, but also too on the social side as well. You look and see how they're regarded within the field. Sometimes we'll look and conduct in human intelligence and examine what do people that have worked with them say about how they are to work with and that kind of thing. So it can encompass a number of different human factors.
Yeah, and this is probably a good point for us to just jump in and just clarify a couple of different terms for people who maybe are getting exposed to this stuff for the first time. So the first chunk of things you talked about, we'd broadly categorize as open source intelligence.
Right, right.
Right. And so help us understand what is Mantor encompassed in terms of open source.
Right. So open source intelligence are really things that you can discover through court records. There are certain databases that we have access to that are restricted in some ways, but are aggregates of state criminal and litigation records, bankruptcy filings, judgments and liens, corporation filings to establish when individuals may have started a company, connections that they may have, property records, address histories, obviously online media. These are all things that would fall under the categories of open source intelligence. And then there's also human intelligence, which is focusing more on what sounds like the human aspect. So interviews, asking around and kind of determining what is not available just in the straight public data sphere that is relevant as far as an individual's background is concerned.
So when you're looking at people like the C-suite, so the executive board, I mean, I know, for example, in a family law proceeding, one partner might have a concern about how the other partner is spending their spare time and how that might impact their suitability to have custody. Mm-hmm. So they may hire a private investigator to surveil them and kind of see what they're getting up to on their weekends. And essentially what it seems like they're doing is checking their moral character. And in some of these executive contracts, there are moral behavior clauses. And so in the process or in the process of doing these investigations, are you also sending out, I guess, teams to verify the moral suitability of potential executives and leaders in these large investment transactions?
Right. That's not necessarily something that we focus on all the time.
Mm-hmm.
We prefer not to necessarily make judgments about that kind of thing. Uh-huh. But that being said, there are definitely cases where if there's a high profile individual, if there's something very public that happens in their personal life that is available in media, that's something that we'll touch on as well. And we have done in the past some of the more, we were technically private investigators, but we operate, I think, in a little bit of a different manner than
yeah. You know,
what would be the traditional sleuth picking up cigarette butts kind of operation. But yeah, so there is occasionally the element of the surveillance, but that's more rare. Usually it's focusing on what's available in open source and then the select interviews as far as human intelligence is concerned. But yeah, there are instances where those kind of things pop up during our investigations, but it's usually focused on online media and things that we would consider to be a potential reputation risk to our clients.
It also seems that things have gotten really sophisticated in the last few years. And I wonder to what extent you're doing forensic investigations as well. So a lot of people are using company-issued laptops and company-issued cell phones. Is that a component of what you guys will do as well as some of that more complex forensic investigation?
Well, that we have done in the past, it's not necessarily something that comes across our desk every day, but it is something that we've done in the past. But it generally is not quite as large of a focus of what our clients want. I think for us, we've been steered generally in the direction of the pre-transaction intelligence, the investment risk, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. We have seen certain sectors of growth within the last year or so. We've seen a lot more legal intelligence work, I think, than some years in the past. That may be because the nature of what COVID has brought. I think with a lot of businesses struggling and going in delinquency on certain payments and that kind of thing, it's kind of brought the litigation to the forefront a little bit more than in previous years. That's a cycle that we've seen, at least as far as our work is concerned. That's kind of more of what we focus on, although we have done the occasional forensic work in the past.
What are the kind of qualities that would make a successful professional in this industry?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. For me, the one thing that jumps out whenever we're conducting interviews here at SIG, to me, it's the attention to detail. That's one thing where we're collecting all these pieces of data and putting them together into these reports. And you really have to be able to sift through all the data irregularities. You have to be able to understand obviously everyone, no one has a unique name. Very rarely you'll come across somebody with a unique name. So you have to sift through records that may not be relevant. You have to be able to connect the dots very well, being able to connect addresses to corporation filings, to different kinds of legal proceedings in certain cases. So I think as far as what makes, I think a lot of my coworkers would agree, what really makes or breaks a lot of analysts that come in, I think, is that attention to detail, being able to pick up those small indicators and really being able to bring them all together to make an overall judgment.
So you mentioned the term analysts. Is that essentially where people begin their career as an analyst?
Yes, at least for us, generally, when someone comes in, usually they come in out of undergraduate or graduate school, and they'll start as an analyst and really dive right into the pre-transaction due diligence. That's a lot of what the analysts will focus on to start. And obviously, as they move up, I started as an analyst, and as I kind of progressed here at SIG, I was able to work on some more complicated projects, ones that are greater overall scope, but as far as years in the past that we look for each investigation, but also depth as well. So understand, diving deeper, not only into the individual's backgrounds and you know, companies, but also political factors that might impact certain investigations, social factors that might impact investigations, a number of things like this.
And how do you describe to people what you do? Because I feel like as soon as people hear intelligence in anything, there's a bunch of conclusions that they draw. So how do you explain it to people?
Right. I guess it kind of depends on who I'm speaking to. But I guess I'll give the explanation that I normally give my family. So I'll give the description of, we essentially find out things for companies to protect their investments. That's a pretty easy way to summarize what a lot of our work is. And really, it all boils down to making sure that the clients are safe in what they're doing, minimizing as much risk as possible. And that's kind of the angle that we approach a lot of our work from. That's normally how I try to boil it down, at least for people that aren't really familiar with the industry.
And is it the kind of industry where the majority of people are fairly young, middle career, or is it one of those kind of older industries where there's a lot of room for people to come in at the bottom and grow?
Yeah, I think there's always people funneling in and out, I feel like, of due diligence and private intelligence, because there's always people that are leaving the government organizations to go into the private sector. And then there's always people that are in the private sector that want to go into the government work. So it's a little bit kind of a revolving door on that front. But I think throughout, there's a lot of great opportunities for people. I think it's for young people, especially. I think it's a field where there's a lot of people go into the university wanting to major in political science or criminal justice or something, international relations, something along those lines.
Yeah.
And think, okay, CIA, FBI, something along those lines. And I don't think it occurs to a lot of people that this entire sphere of work that is not necessarily being underutilized, but there's a lot of room for growth within the sector. And I think we're seeing that. And I think there's a lot of room for people that may not want to go into the government, or they decide maybe law is not for me, or one of these other paths, they might decide that this is a good route for them. So I think there's a lot of room, there's a lot of flexibility, and it's really engaging work. We like to have our process at SIG and understand we have zero-based intelligence where we come in not assuming anything in every investigation and adding up all the pieces that come together. But at the same time, even though we have our process, every investigation is different. There's always something really engaging that we're working on. And as you are able to progress in your career, you're really able to expand and work in some different areas. So I think it's a great field for people to go into, particularly when you're just coming out of school. And like I said, maybe the CIA or the FBI route is not for you, or maybe you decide that law school is not where you want to head. It's a great option.
It certainly sounds very sexy, but I think there's a lot of career paths where the reality is very different to the picture that we have in our minds. Mm-hmm. So help us understand, what does an ordinary day look like for you at SIG in terms of, and when do you usually get to the office? When do you usually get to leave? Right. Do you have to take work home? Is there call? Give us a sense of that.
So I'm going to kind of break it up into two parts, because the analysts, beginning as an analyst is a little bit different from being an associate director, and the responsibilities are a little bit different. And I've kind of been able to, I've been lucky enough to grow in my role. So it's not quite all investigative at this point. But as an analyst, normally you get into the office at about 8 a.m. You'll have probably one or two different assignments, usually pre-transaction intelligence. If you have a particular language fluency or you're familiar with a particular jurisdiction, I grew up in Canada for quite a while, lived just outside Toronto. So you have a particularly strong knowledge of a certain country, you might focus on there. I started off doing more and more of our Canadian work as I started. So, and kind of working on your investigations throughout the day, that's kind of how it starts as an analyst, using your open source intelligence methods to gather data. And then everybody kind of has their own ways of conducting the investigations as far as what they want to look at first, what pieces of the puzzle they want to get put together, what way. Some people start at the corners and some people want to put together sections in the middle and then move their way out. It really is like that. So I feel like a lot of analysts will tell you they kind of operate in a different way, but ultimately finishing your investigations and completing your report, and we normally send it off to edit and then eventually to the client. So that's kind of the general day of an analyst. And you normally 4:30, 5 o'clock is normally when we get off, when the analysts get off for the day. Great work-life balance at SIG. That's one of the things when I started that really stood out to me about our company, is that they really take pride in making sure that the analysts are doing well and enjoying their time at the company. For me now, it's a little bit different. Just for one day this week, I woke up a little bit early because I had a call with a fellow from Israel. So I had to get up a little bit early for that because of the time difference. I had that call that lasted about an hour. Worked on an investigation in between. I had a management call, got back working on some investigations that I have, and then helping out analysts with questions. If somebody else, one of the associate directors, if we're working on a project, we might chat to discuss the logistics of the project, how far along we are, if there's any red flags, do we need to inform the client, that kind of thing. So it kind of depends based on where you are in the organization. For me, the day always starts at 8. Sometimes it ends at 5. Sometimes it goes a little bit later, depending on what projects we have, depending on the deadlines. Some are tighter than others. We have a project that's expedited for a client, we'll prioritize that work and make sure that it gets out on time so that they can have all their security before they finalize their investment. So it just kind of depends on what's going on and the workload and really what the client's needs for each particular project are.
And was it fairly easy to work from home, or did you find that because of perhaps some of the sensitivity of the information you guys are looking at, everything had to be done at the office on secure servers?
Right. Well, I think that's one thing that we've been able to adapt to really well. Prior to going out of the office for COVID, we had pretty strong security protocols as far as encryption is concerned, as far as personal policies are concerned for working and the sharing of data and this kind of thing. So I feel like we were pretty well placed for when everybody had to work from home almost, it seemed like, with no notice. And it was almost a seamless transition. There are some bumps in the road early on, just as far as making sure that the communication was different, because we can't just knock on each other's door. It wasn't that easy. So for being a lot of the work that we do is over desktop. And despite that, it's a very collaborative environment. Sometimes we'll be in a situation where there might be a series where we have 5 subjects. We might be investigating the company, and then the CEO, chief operating officer, the chief technology officer, and a vice president or something. And one person will be working on one part of the investigation, another on another part of the investigation, and then a third person on the final part and the final subject. And there's a lot of collaboration that goes into that, because sometimes just because of the nature of the data array and what you find in open source and in media, sometimes you'll find something that's relevant to another subject within the investigation, right? So it becomes a lot more collaborative than you might think. And so back when we were still in the office, it would be a thing where someone could lean over and discuss something with somebody in a conference room, or knock on somebody's office door and have those conversations. But now it kind of transitioned into relying, instead of so much on the in-person, I guess we've really transitioned to the Zoom, the conference calls, Google Meets, all these kinds of other outlets to get our message across to one another. And I think it's actually worked really well. And so we've kind of really gone from, we love being in the office, but it's one of those things where it grew into, okay, now we can see what the benefits of working remotely are, and it gives us a lot of flexibility. It gives the analysts a lot of flexibility. So it ended up working out really well for us.
Yeah, it's going to be just, I mean, talking more broadly, I think it's going to be very interesting to see what happens the longer the working from home arrangement becomes the norm. If you're working at a big tech company in San Francisco, you're making a San Francisco wage.
Yes. So
if you don't have to be in San Francisco, there are people who are moving to Texas and Oklahoma and places where the cost of living is substantially lower. And some of those companies are adjusting accordingly. Others aren't. So I think it's just opened up a really interesting series of questions about the future of work. I wonder if you could maybe give us some advice for someone who, I guess a two-part question. How would someone go about getting some experience or getting an opportunity if they are coming straight out of college to enter this industry? And then part two of that question is, what if someone is in mid or later career and they're really just, they need a change. They've listened to this and it sounds like something that is particularly interesting to them. So how would those two different groups of people go about exploring and getting an opportunity in this?
Right. So that's a great question. And I think actually it's answerable for both are answerable in the same fashion. So in private intelligence, it's not just people that have worked in the CIA. There's journalists, there's former lawyers, there's former law enforcement. There's so many different kinds of avenues that people have used to get into private intelligence that for those coming from a different background that might have security or surveillance experience, that might have strong understanding of the law, that have legal experience, that have experience in journalism that really allows your research and your writing skills to shine. These are all qualities that a lot of firms look at. And so for folks that have those kinds of career paths that have been on those roads or similar, those where there's a lot of research and writing going on, a lot of analytical skills are involved, those are really great avenues for folks to transition into private intelligence. And then for those that are younger and they may want to break into the field, I would say I would give the same answer, but kind of on a smaller scale. So actually, when I was an undergraduate student, I interned at a law firm over in Dallas, which was a great experience for me as far as getting me more aware with legal terminology, being just firsthand experience reading legal documents, things like that really helped me when I got on the job. And those are seeing that somebody worked in a law firm. That's something that I think, at least for us, that's a quality internship or professional experience that we'd like to see on a resume. And I also worked as a writer, as a journalist while I was in graduate school as well, part-time, not necessarily full-time, but still it provided some of the research and the writing experience that kind of allowed me to get noticed. And I think that helped as well. So for those that are in school or maybe have just graduated, those kind of internships, I think, really help build your resume and that kind of work experience as well. I think you can really use those as kind of a springboard into the private intelligence field. And my family has lived in Texas for a long time. Strategic Insight Group is based in Fort Worth, and my family lives just north of Fort Worth. So I was lucky enough to be able to essentially come back home after living in England, and was lucky enough to get into the field that I wanted in a geographic location that was perfect for me. But at the same time, I would tell people that are interested in the field to be open to new experiences as far as moving to a different city. If it's something you really want to do, there are so many opportunities at different firms across the country. Really do your research, understand the market, understand kind of what private intelligence is really for, understanding what the clients are looking for, that it's really a risk mitigation tool. Understand who you want to work for. At least for us, I'm always impressed when somebody knows a lot about our company, because that's kind of our job, is to find things out about other people's companies. So it's always a plus when somebody has that natural curiosity about what we do. So those are things that I always like to see. And that's the advice that I would kind of give for both new professionals and experienced folks that want to find a way into private intelligence and kind of the due diligence world as a whole.
One of the questions we ask everybody on the podcast is, where do they see their profession or industry
in the next 10 to 15 years? And so I want to ask you, where do you see the world of private intelligence going in the next 10 to 15 years?
That's a great question. And I think it's every field has their challenges. I think we have some very unique challenges of our own in private intelligence and due diligence, particularly on the background front. Data protection globally has gotten a lot more strict. GDPR has limited a lot of access to what due diligence firms are able to, kind of records are available.
And can you just clarify for listeners what GDPR is?
Yes. So there are folks that will know this a lot better than I can explain. Essentially, it is legislation that was passed in Europe that limited the public access of personal data, personal information. With our field relying heavily on access to public records, a lot of open source intelligence, there are certain records that were kind of put in the background that it makes it more difficult for us to operate. And obviously, there are human intelligence sources that can kind of fill the gaps in a lot of areas, understanding people's background and that kind of thing. But a lot of the privacy legislation, I think, is changing the game, so to speak. In the U.S., I know there are a few states where you were experiencing some similar legislation being passed. So for private intelligence,
California.
Yes, California is one of them. I think Virginia and New York as well. So for private intelligence, I think it's going to be kind of back to the roots, I guess. There's going to be, I think, a renewed focus on the human aspect. What can private intelligence and due diligence firms gather from human sources? I think that's going to be something that we continue to see. And what role AI, artificial intelligence, will play in data collection, both from a due diligence perspective, but also in general. So there are firms out there that are able to compile a lot of public data very quickly and produce background reports on folks in a matter of hours, and which I think that's great technology. But then with a lot of countries and a lot of states passing the legislation that we just talked about, how is that going to impact what firms in the automated due diligence space, how is that going to impact them moving forward? I think that's something that will be interesting to see as well. So I think overall, that's kind of where I see our field going. Less reliance on public records and being a little bit more creative in the way in which we conduct investigations as far as human intelligence is concerned and that kind of thing. And obviously will vary based on jurisdictions as well. But that's kind of how I see the overarching trend to be right now.
And I forgot to follow up on this a little earlier, but you mentioned how you were looking for things like attention to detail and inquisitive minds. You were a poli-sci major, but it doesn't sound like it's an industry where you need a particular major. Or would you be willing to hire people without a college degree if they've got some of those other intangibles?
Right, absolutely.
Or skills.
I think to answer the first part of your question, I think any degree where someone can really hone their analytical skills, their research, their attention to detail is one that would be considered. It's not as if we wouldn't hire somebody who has a chemistry degree because they didn't write enough necessarily, right? Because obviously that brings attention to detail in just different areas, right? So it's not necessarily major specific. And there are a lot of people that have 10 plus years in intelligence in a branch of the military where they don't have a college degree, but they have some of the best experience you can possibly get. So those are absolutely people that we would and have hired in the past as well. So definitely not limited to a degree. And with the experience, particularly in the military or law enforcement, I think as well is an area where there's some of those skills can cross over depending on the firm and the kind of work that the firm does, each individual private intelligence company. I think there's a lot of room there for folks with different backgrounds as well.
If people have heard what you've had to say and their interest has been piqued, where can they go and how would they go about finding some more about Strategic Insight Group?
Right. So I would tell them to obviously check out our website, learn a little bit more about our team. We have some amazing people that we work with, some of the brightest people I've been around, some of the most hardworking, a great group of folks. Look at the services we offer and learn a little bit more about the due diligence industry as a whole. I think the catalyst that started me on my path in private intelligence was me reading an article in The Economist way back when I was just finishing up at undergrad.
That old chestnut.
Yeah, absolutely. And it kind of put me down this rabbit hole of learning more about the field, reaching out to people, and absolutely reach out to folks within the industry here at SIG, but also wherever you can to learn more and ask questions and kind of see if the field is the right one for you.
Adam, this has been really interesting. I think it'll certainly pique the interest of a lot of our listeners. So thank you so much for joining us and for sharing your experience and insights in the private intelligence industry.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.